WGN, the show's called Your Money Matters. We do it Monday through Thursdays right at this time, and we start the show with the numbers that matter. So it was kind of good news, bad news on the inflation report. The prices rose 0.6% month over month. That's actually the worst level in like 14 months. No good. But a lot of that was gas prices. The core numbers we've talked about was still up, but about half of that. We're going to break it all down with Greg McBride in just a moment. The U.S. recorded an $89 billion budget surplus in August. You don't hear surpluses all that often, compared with a $220 billion deficit last year. But don't get too excited. Experts say the improvement was due to technical government accounting. Okay. Leaders of the United Auto Workers Union, they're considering targeted strikes at a small number of factories run by each of the three automakers out of Detroit if they can't reach a contract agreement by tomorrow night. Yeah, we're going to be talking about this a lot tomorrow. We'll follow the UAW potential strike. Could mean a big deal to the economy. Gas prices down a penny across our region, though. And those are the numbers that matter on Your Money Matters on this Wednesday, September 13th, 2023. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. We will talk cars tonight, not about the potential strike, but about what's fascinating and happening with Toyota. They were like one of the leading automakers when it came to new technology and their hybrids. And they are the world's largest car maker, and they are woefully behind at electric vehicles. What does that mean to you all? Well, we'll talk about that a little bit later with Jack Ewing from the New York Times. But right now we got Greg McBride joining us, chief financial analyst at Bankrate. And Greg, I think that the inflation report today had something for optimists and something for pessimists. So a little bit of everything today.
Yes, yeah, definitely something for everybody in the sense that we continue to see some progress, but I think we have some of the remaining trouble spots, and I think a new flare-up we got to keep an eye on, but those gas prices, I mean, if gas and oil prices are sustained at this high level for any period of time, that could start to ripple out to other goods and services. That's something we'll have to keep an eye on over the next few months.
Yeah, and I know that the Fed likes looking at the core number to get a sense and a feel for how inflation is. But like the rest of us, gas prices count just as much as anything else. Like if we're paying at the pump more, that's the real inflation I feel like we feel, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason that the Fed and economists talk about the core is not that food and energy don't count. They certainly count, especially the inflation we've seen over the last couple of years. But what core does is it really gives you a better sense of what the trend is in inflation. Food and energy can be really volatile. I mean, they can be up big one month, down big the next, that kind of thing. And that can kind of distort the picture. So if you kind of block that out and just look at everything else, that gives you a better sense of the trend of inflation. So, yes, gas prices were up very notably. They accounted for more than half of the increase in the monthly CPI. So when you strip that plus food out and look at just the core, prices were only up half as much, 0.3% for the month. On a year-over-year basis, that core number is at 4.3%. It's coming down. It was in a bit of a holding pattern at around 5.5% early part of this year. So it's been coming down steadily, but 4.3% still a lot higher than 2%, and that's the ultimate goal. So still a ways to go on that.
Yeah, I want to ask you where people think we're going next. More with Greg McBride from Bankrate. First, at 6:15, let's get a look at weather and traffic. Mayor, how are we doing out there? We choose Greg McBride, chief financial analyst at Bankrate, to break things down for us. Okay, talking about inflation, the overall number up from a couple months ago, we were down to 3% flat, 3.6% year over year, I believe, was the reading we got today. Core slowly coming down, very slowly. So, Greg, are there any voices out there when they see that we've gone up 0.6% month over month in overall prices, like, ringing alarm bells that we could get runaway inflation again? Or is it more like, this could be stickier than we thought?
Well, it wasn't unexpected. And a lot of that, again, because of the run-up in oil and gasoline prices. So it was up 0.6%, but that was in line with expectations. So, I think where you worry is when you get blindsided by something, when there's something that wasn't expected. And even though the numbers, weren't great, certainly not at the headline level, that wasn't really a surprise. The core was up a little bit faster than expected, but still, that year over year numbers is trending down. So, you know, things are moving in the right direction. And when we, you know, peel back the onion and really kind of look at the different components, there's, broadly speaking, things are moving in the right direction. So things that used to exert a lot of inflationary pressure on the household budget as recently as 6 months or a year ago, they've eased. Food is a great example of that. Food at home, what we buy at the supermarket, food away from home, what we have when we're dining out. You know, in both of those cases, they had been going up by leaps and bounds month after month after month, as we all recall. Seems like yesterday. But it's really moderated over the past several months. And so now, you know, over the last 12 months, food at home is only up 3%. It was up just 0.2% for the month of August. And so that's more closer to the destination than, you know, where we had been earlier. So, and there's, you know, a number of other categories where it's moderating, but there's still some trouble spots. I mentioned gasoline. Fuel oil is another one. A couple of those energy components are problematic. Motor vehicle insurance and repair costs and personal care. Those are necessities. They're necessities for most households, and yet they continue to go up at an outsized pace. So, I mean, those are the ones that, you know, they're still the problem children here. We haven't seen the easing in those categories, and we have to before households are going to, you know, have any hope of relief. And then the fly in the ointment is, what do we see with oil and gas prices over, say, the next few months? Do they move higher? Do they stay elevated at the current levels? Does that start to ripple out to other goods and services? I mean, after all, everything we buy, whether it's in a store or online, it gets transported at some point along the way. Plenty of service-oriented businesses are very sensitive to oil and fuel costs, and so they, too, can mark prices up if they're feeling that pinch. That's what we're going to have to watch over the next few months.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that even that headline number, which includes gas, if that goes up too quickly because of gas, that could affect, quote-unquote, the core number at some point because, well, not directly in the core number, all the other goods and services sold and that are taken a hard look at by the Fed and the core number and everyone else, that could trick up if it goes on long enough and high enough.
Yeah, exactly. And we had seen that earlier. That's one of the reasons we've been head faked on inflation a couple times over the past couple of years where we thought, oh, it peaked. And then it just, you know, it kept going higher. And one of the reasons was that we saw oil prices move up pretty sharply after the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. And in the 6 months that after that, you started to see that really begin to affect some of the core goods and services. Not a pathway we want to go down again. That's something that's definitely worth watching.
People at the grocery store, they might say, okay, the numbers aren't going up quite as high, quite as fast. That's really hard to quantify, I think, for everyday folks. I think you kind of know when you see it, like, okay, things have stabilized. I think a lot of people are waiting for, when are those prices going to go down? Is that ever going to happen, Greg?
Broadly speaking, no. When we talk about getting inflation under control or inflation coming down, we're not talking about prices falling. We're not going back to 2020 or 2019 price levels. What we're talking about is just prices not going up as fast. And the problem was that for the better part of 2 years, inflation went up, and it went up faster than incomes. So buying power for households really got squeezed. And, you know, the damage from that is that we've seen households running down savings and piling up credit card debt. Well, even with inflation showing signs of moderating, there's still a lot of catching up to do. There's a compounding effect here. So, even though we're back to a point where wage growth is exceeding inflation, there's a lot of ground to be made up from the past couple of years where inflation was exceeding that wage growth. So it's probably going to be the middle of next year before households have the same level of buying power that they had this time 2 years ago.
Greg, I got in an argument with a stranger on Twitter, which is a great use of your time, everyone. Trust me. arguing that I'm not going to be satisfied, not me, but this Twitter user, or X user, I should say, until prices go back to what they were in 2018. And I made the point, like, yeah, that would make us all feel better. But in fact, deflation, consistent and long term, that is a sign of a real problem in an economy under normal times, right?
It's an economic death spiral. I mean, look at Japan. I mean, they basically had 30 years with essentially no economic growth, and then 30 years where their stock market, went backwards. So, and a lot of that because of the fact that they had deflation, they didn't tackle it early on, and, the problem just kind of perpetuated itself.
So, yes, I was right, is what you're saying on Twitter.
John was right.
That's all. That's really why I brought you here today, Greg. I knew you'd swing at that one for me. No, I appreciate your time. Thanks for breaking this down, Greg. As always, we'll talk soon, okay?
Always a pleasure, John. Thanks so much.
Chief Financial Analyst at Bankrate. Hey, before I take this break and go to the news, I wanted to bring in my buddy Andy Mazur here. I saw this headline, Andy.
Mm-hmm.
Crane Chicago Business. White Sox attendance too low for over a decade for team to owe state fees. And I read through it. I didn't get it. Can you explain it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the White Sox, they pay rent to the Illinois Facilities and Sporting Authority. I think that's what it's called.
The thing that kept the Sox from going to Florida?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's up to about $1.6 million a year now is what they pay in the rent. But there's a clause in there that that has added revenue for the authority if the White Sox sell tickets over $1.93 million. So they haven't gotten to that number in the last decade, so they have not had to pay the overage at that point. I think it's more of a fair split, in their opinion, rather than the White Sox being able to keep all their ticket revenues past a certain point.
Mm.
They need to share, and it's more of a, I think that was one of the agreements as far as adding that to the rent.
I saw someone comment saying that's why they're trying to keep attendance low. That wouldn't make any sense, though. If you make attendance higher, you make more money, even
yeah.
if you have to pay a little bit more.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're not benefiting by not selling a lot of tickets, because you get to keep that money if it's below 1.93. I mean, you're still not going to make as much if you do over, even if you pay.
I'm just all about quashing strangers on the internet's arguments today.
Squash them like a bug.
Greg helped me out of Bankrate. You helped me out of the sports department.
Nice. I'm glad I could help.
Thank you very much, Andy Mazur. Okay, let's take a break. John Hansen here. We'll take you till 7 o'clock. Jack Ewing joins us now from the New York Times. I, Jack, have to admit, I don't know a ton about cars, but I'm certainly interested in the transition to EVs. Though when I bought a car at the height of when no one could find cars, I didn't have many choices, and I ended up with a Toyota Hybrid, and I like it, and I never thought to even look around the floor to find out if they had more EVs. But, Jack, apparently Toyota is way behind in this game, huh?
Yeah, and you sort of hit on the reason is that they've been very successful with EVs. They're very popular. It's profitable for Toyota, but they've been slow to go all the way to battery-powered vehicles and have a very slim offering in the United States and are really falling behind.
Yeah, so they obviously were, like you say in this article, it's very well written, by the way. Ben Dooley on the co-byline with you did a lot of research into this, but walk us through a little bit of Toyota's history as an automaker and why this may be surprising to some people that they're so far behind this.
Yeah, well, if you go way back to the 70s, I mean, it was really Toyota that introduced the whole idea of the fuel-efficient, a very high-quality vehicle, and really put a lot of pressure on the Detroit automakers to up their game. And Toyota was also the pioneer in hybrids, cars that combine a battery with a gasoline motor and are much more fuel efficient. And they've also been the model in terms of manufacturing efficiency. There's a whole bookshelves of books about the way that Toyota manufactures. So it's had a huge influence on the industry.
What is it lost in this, or are they making a calculated move, they say?
I think they were just very slow to recognize how important electric vehicles would be and how fast people would buy electric vehicles. That's true not only in the United States, but particularly in China, which has actually become the biggest auto market in the world, and where electric vehicles now account for more than a third of all the new cars sold.
Whoa.
So not having a strong offering in that segment is a big problem. In fact, Toyota's sales in China are going down. So these are all warning signs. And I think Toyota thought they had time. They thought they had a couple of years. I mean, they still say that that's the case. But it's looking, increasingly dicey for them.
So how do they catch up? Are they trying to?
They say they are. They did have a big management change earlier this year. And they've promised that they're going to have some breakthrough battery technology in a couple of years, batteries that will be lighter and cheaper and charge very quickly. And when this new technology comes online, then they will have a big selling point. But remains to be seen whether that's the case and whether others might get there first.
They're obviously still a huge automaker, and I imagine still turning up big profits. And obviously, they are a Japanese company, but of course, they have such strong roots here in the U.S. and employ a lot of workers. So this could have ripple effects if they are if they do fall behind. But again, they still have a long way to go. They're still a very popular car company.
Yeah, no, they're still making lots of money. You know, they're not in any danger of going out of business. But they do employ a lot of people in the United States, I think around 30,000, you know, just directly at their factories, then plus many more in suppliers and the restaurants to the factories and all of that. And then in Japan, a hugely influential company, big part of the economy. So if Toyota has problems, really the entire Japanese economy has problems. So they are important. And maybe the other point to make is, you know, we've really counted on the Japanese car makers to provide us with high-quality, economical cars. And at the moment, not only Toyota, but all the Japanese car makers are basically, you know, missing in action as far as the electric vehicle revolution is concerned.
Anything else that you found interesting you want to make sure our listeners leave with?
No, I think that's the big point as well. Maybe I'll say this, that you probably shouldn't underestimate Toyota. They are the biggest car maker in the world, selling more than 10 million cars a year. So I wouldn't count them out, but I'd also keep a close eye that this isn't the moment when they kind of get knocked off their perch.
We'll have to wait and see. Jack Ewing, I appreciate your time today from the New York Times. Great writing. I read all of your articles, and it's a thrill to get to chat with you.
Thank you, John. Very happy to be here. Thanks very much.
We'll talk again soon. 6:45, Brian Heater joins us, editor at TechCrunch. Yesterday, we were wondering what the new Apple 15 has to offer when it does. And Brian, I just thought, well, let's get an expert on. Thanks for joining us, my friend.
My pleasure.
So you were at the event, right? What are these events like for those that may have never been or never really watched one before?
Sure. It's actually shifted quite a bit over the last few years. So obviously the pandemic came along and they stopped having them in person for a few years there. At that point, Apple moved to a pre-recorded keynote. So they're basically these like super slickly produced videos, a lot of sweeping drone shots and things like that. And now it's held at Apple Park in the very nice Steve Jobs Theater, and we're kind of sitting around basically watching one of those videos in real time.
There's no like speech or anything that no one comes out and talks live?
There is. So it used to be entirely live. Tim Cook now comes out for talks for about 20 seconds, and then the video happens. And It's still a very interesting experience. You know, once the keynote is finished, and we all file into the hands-on area that opens up directly behind us, and you've got all the like iPhones and Apple Watches and everything else to try in person.
Cool. All right, so tell us about what we got here. The 15, it didn't impress investors yesterday. The stock was down 2%. I didn't check it today. Are you impressed by what you see with the 15?
I think that there is one extremely exciting thing about the 15. Apple obviously talked about it a bit. It wasn't a huge part of the conversation because effectively they, to a certain extent, they had their hand forced. There was some legislation that came through in the European Union at the end of last year that effectively requires phone manufacturers, just consumer electronics manufacturers, to use the USB-C port, which is pretty much standard and ubiquitous across Android handsets right now. It's that sort of like ovular one that if you have an Android handset produced in the last few years, you probably have it. So they finally moved over to that. So now it's completely standardized across devices. So you can use the same cable that you use with your to charge your MacBook or your iPad or anything else. So that's a big deal. The truth of the matter is that phones are, it's really hard to buy a bad phone at this point, especially if you're willing to pay, several hundred dollars for them. They're all pretty good. So the battles are largely being fought on the camera side of things. And Apple has done some really impressive camera stuff, especially on the Pro and Pro Max devices in terms of portrait mode that they're able to shoot. They introduced 5X optical zoom, which, you know, basically means you can get a much tighter image without without degrading it. Newer chip, they're going to be making a larger and larger push into gaming. They ran some demos, and, you know, it's pretty impressive that you can get something that is almost a console quality game running on your device.
That's cool. You, in the article I read at TechCrunch.com, the iPhone 15 is, quote, the most pro iPhone we've ever created. What does that mean?
I think, so it's a couple of things. The camera is a really big part of it. You know, Apple's bread and butter has always been creative pros. So, you know, generally when they're using the word pros, it's talking about people like video editors, like audio editors, photographers, people who need a lot of computing power in order to, to create the content that they're making. So the camera is a really big part of that. The video that it's able to shoot is really impressive. And over the last, several years, we've actually seen like real Hollywood films being shot on iPhones. Tangerine was a Oscar-nominated film that came out a few years ago. They're able to shoot 4K. The image stabilization is really good. And then I do think that when they say that, an aspect of that, frankly, is also the port. I know I'm like really harping on this port a lot, but it is really important. And one of the things that it brings is much faster data transfer. So, like, among other things, you can hook your phone directly up to a hard drive and, you know, shoot a bunch of videos and photos and automatically get them on an external drive.
That's smart. Yeah, because as of now, sometimes when I have things on my iPhone I need somewhere else, it's a game of airdropping and trying to figure out how to do it. And the thought that it would have the same port as the computer or other mechanisms certainly does seem to make life easier. Cost-wise, I was actually kind of surprised. I know that the Pro Max, which I don't think I'd ever consider getting, is around $1,200. But the other ones are, I mean, they're not cheap, don't get me wrong, but they seem to be fairly in line with prices we've had even a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Apple has kept it pretty steady. The Pro Max is very expensive. It's I think like $1,200 to start. Part of that, you know, and one of the things I didn't mention in terms of what's new here is they've upgraded to a titanium body. iPhones before and most smartphones are made with aluminum. Titanium is both much stronger and much lighter. So if you walk into an Apple store and pick up one of these things, you'll notice that the iPhone 14 Pros were extremely heavy phones, and it's really like night and day on these devices.
I have one last question for you. We were joking yesterday that, and I did find one poll from years ago that a lot of iPhone users don't even know what phone they have. They don't remember the number they bought. I was in that camp. I have a 12 Pro. I ultimately was able to obviously find it on my own phone. But what I guess I want to know is, for someone that has like a 13 or a 12 that works well, has enough storage, the battery life is still sustainable enough, do you think this is the phone that gets them to renew and buy a new one, or you think people are still okay waiting a bit for just your basic stuff?
Yeah, so I have a couple of thoughts on that. Broadly speaking, if you look at the figures, smartphone sales have like declined pretty much across the board, and a big part of the reason, obviously, you know, there's like supply chain stuff. There's a lot of economic headwinds. People just, you know, don't have the disposable income that they used to. But a big part of it is the fact that like as I said before, all of these devices are really good, and now that people aren't tied to carrier contracts the way that they used to be, there's no reason to upgrade your device every year or every other year. I would say if it's working for you, then, you know, keep it. It's great. That's less like e-waste in the world, which is absolutely a good thing. The flip side of that, I had a friend last year asked me maybe like 8 or 9 months ago whether she should get a new iPhone, and I told her to wait for this one because I do think that the USB port is going to be a really big deal for a lot of people. And part of the reason is, like, frankly, the Lightning port, they've been using that for about 11 years, and it's just not a great
port. It's the worst.
You know?
It's the worst.
Yeah. my you know, every time I use it, it wears down. Yeah. It was good at the time. It was better than micro USB, but like USB-C is just an absolutely great standard.
All right, Brian Heater. Hey, thanks for coming on the show. We'll have to have you on again soon, okay?
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Editor at TechCrunch. By the way, the Mincing Rascals, I can see John Williams already editing or still editing the podcast that'll go out tonight. We're going to be live at the Second City Tuesday, September 26th, sponsored by Allied First Bank. Tickets are on sale at WGNRadio.com/Rascals.